These are all portions of the 40 pounds of moon rocks that Neil Armstrong collected on the Sea of Tranquility in July 1969.
Alaska celebrates the return of its moon rocks after a four-decade absence. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, December 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, another battle between the state and federal government over Denali National Park.
It's a renewed intrusion of this traditional role of the state agency as the principal manager that we're seeing.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The three-person public safety department on the Pribilof Island of St. Paul shut down this week, suddenly and without a great deal of explanation, leaving the Bering Sea Island without an on-site law enforcement presence. For the past few months, there's been tension between the community and the police department, and there is some indication that the closure is in response to that. KUCB reporter Stephanie Joyce has been following the story and joins us now. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Lori.
What's happening on the island right now?
So on Tuesday, the city of St. Paul posted on Facebook that their police department would be shutting down temporarily due to unanticipated staff departures. And the city turned over law enforcement authority to the state troopers. That's even though the closest state troopers are in Anchorage, which is a three-hour flight away in good weather, and the Pribilofs don't get much of that. So the police chief says that there have been threats made against the officers' lives. He didn't say that their departure was related to those threats, although there may be some connection between those two.
Why would there be threats made against the officers?
Well, you know, without being on the ground, it's really hard to say exactly what's happening in the community, but it seems like there are a lot of people in St. Paul who are really unhappy with the police department at the moment. There's been tension building for months between the police department and community members who really don't feel like the police represent them. This all sort of started at a council meeting in June when community members presented a petition about the Department of Public Safety's cultural awareness and community sensitivity. You know, during that same period of time, there were also threats being made against officers. There was sabotage of police vehicles and equipment. You know, basically things were getting out of control.
So, Stephanie, what did the city do?
The city council hired an independent investigator to come in. Dave Sexton is a police officer in Skagway. He used to be the executive director of the Alaska Police Standards Council, and he was also a police officer in St. Paul in the 80s. And he concluded that, let's just play some tape of what he concluded.
There was certainly a belief that some people were being intimidated or harassed by the police department. I found a great deal of secondhand and third-hand stories, though. When you actually talk to people, they were kind of repeating issues and versions that they had heard other people talk about. I didn't really find anything out of the norm the way St. Paul was doing things. St. Paul, the police department, I found nothing that actually wasn't pretty darn best standards or pretty much state-of-the-art.
He also concluded that racism definitely played a factor. He says that racism and discrimination were actually being directed primarily at non-natives, and the police chief has also said that. He's African-American and says that he was the subject of racial slurs. The final thing that the report concluded was that it would be really helpful for the city to bring in a mediator because clearly there were some valid concerns by community members, even though, you know, Sexton didn't find that their conclusions were warranted.
Stephanie, what's going to happen next? Is it known?
It's not entirely clear what's going to happen to the officers who left. The current chief was already scheduled to retire at the end of the month, so he'll be doing that. But the other officers, their fate has yet to be determined. And then the tribe has also issued a statement, you know, acknowledging that they have concerns with the police department, but saying that they are willing to cooperate with the city. So it seems like things are on their way to being resolved.
All right. Thanks, Stephanie, for helping us understand this.
Thanks, Lori.
Stephanie Joyce is a reporter at KUCB in Unalaska. Several long-lost moon rocks were handed over to the state of Alaska today in Anchorage. The rocks were missing for about four decades. When they were found, they became the center of a legal battle. Now they're heading back to the Alaska State Museum in Juneau. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
They're tiny, about the size of a pinky fingernail and smaller, iridescent flecks of stone chipped off bigger rocks that astronauts brought back from the Apollo 11 mission to the moon in 1969. But they're valuable. Steve Henriksen is curator of collections at the Alaska State Museum in Juneau.
And these are all portions of the 40 pounds of moon rocks that Neil Armstrong collected on the Sea of Tranquility in July 1969. It's mounted on a walnut base, and it has a sphere of plexiglass, and the moon rocks are embedded in that. And right below that is an Alaska flag that also was carried to the moon by Apollo 11.
Henriksen says he's been thinking about the rocks since he was told about the cold case when he took the job with the museum back in 1988. He says the museum is thrilled to have them back.
You know, 30-some years to really pull all the pieces together, but when it came time, when the moon rock finally came out of the woodwork, we were already loaded for bear and really went after it, and we were very fortunate to be able to return it to Alaska.
The moon rocks were given to Alaska by President Richard Nixon. All the states got such displays after the successful mission to the moon. Alaska's traveled around the state and was put on display at the Alaska Transportation Museum in Anchorage until a fire there in 1973. That's when they disappeared. Then they resurfaced 39 years later in the possession of a Texas man who grew up in Alaska and was profiled on the reality TV show Deadliest Catch. Arthur Coleman Anderson was the foster son of someone who worked at the museum during the 70s, officials say. Anderson filed a lawsuit asking the Alaska Superior Court to either declare him the moon rock's official owner or to compensate him handsomely for caring for them. He asserted the state had abandoned the moon rocks after the fire. Alaska Assistant Attorney General Neil Slotnick was the lead counsel on the moon rock case.
We filed a motion with the court asking that the plaintiff be ordered to produce the moon rocks and turn them over to NASA for safe custody pending trial. The court did sign that order, and the plaintiff actually drove the moon rocks from his home in Corpus Christi to Johnson Space Center in Houston and handed over custody to NASA.
Once they had them safely at NASA, the space agency and the FBI worked together to authenticate them. Actually, testing them would have meant crushing them up and destroying them. So instead, they used old photographs and sophisticated analysis. The one that helped them confirm the moon rocks were authentic came from a woman named Marie White, who now lives in Washington State. Slotnick explains.
And lo and behold, I got this email from Marie White, and I want to read it to you. I read the Sunday Seattle Times article about your moon rock case. When I was age 8, the moon rocks came to Glen Allen School as a special exhibit for our science fair. Attached is a photo of my brother Gene White and me holding the moon rocks in their plexiglass and wood display case. The photo was taken in the main dining room of our tourist lodge at Lassa House outside of Glen Allen. We had the moon rocks at our lodge because my father was the president of the science fair committee at the school and spearheaded the moon rocks visit.
The photo was used to confirm that the moon rocks were indeed real, and Slotnick says it was one critical piece of evidence. Over the years, curators at the museum maintained files containing evidence and testimony from officials, saying they'd seen the moon rocks in a display case in the rubble after the fire. Those files became the basis of the state's successful case. Cindy Holdreth teaches 8th grade science at Mears Middle School. She brought some of her students to see the return of the moon rocks at the Anchorage School District Education Center.
The students who are here today are doing reports on Neil Armstrong, and so we kind of had information that this was happening, and so we were allowed to invite our students who were researching the original Apollo 11 mission. And so it's great that they got to be here today to see the rocks return to Alaska.
Sean Gardeline goes to Mears. He says he chose to do his report on Neil Armstrong and Apollo 11 because they showed people they could do things they dream about. He says the moon rocks are cool, but...
I thought they were going to be a little bit bigger, but they're still pretty cool.
Seeing the moon rocks for himself, Gardeline says, made what he was learning in school more real, something many more students will have the opportunity to experience with the return of the moon rocks. They'll be on display at the State Museum in Juneau through the month of December, then travel to other museums around Alaska. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, advice to the youngest legislator in the upcoming session from someone who's been there before.
I think it's a matter of just demonstrating that, you know, you are serious, that you're willing to do your homework.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
There's a rift in Congress over whether the country should export its glut of natural gas. A new report released by the U.S. Department of Energy is bolstering the hopes of those who want to see more exports. APRN's Peter Granitz reports.
The report shows that controlled exports of liquefied natural gas would add revenue to the U.S. economy. Fadel Gate is a senior energy analyst with Oppenheimer. He says exports would increase profits of domestic gas producers.
If it is managed well, I think it could be beneficial for the producer and will encourage more supply and also have room for reasonably priced natural gas in the U.S., competitive, if I might add, when compared to any other market in the world.
Gate says the report leaves some questions unanswered.
How long it will take to get this program going, how much is going to cost, is there going to be tax incentives, there's going to be what is the government's role is going to be.
The report does not examine Alaska's export potential. The state already exports some Cook Inlet gas to Japan, and any increased North Slope production would ship to Asia as well, though it would require a pipeline costing tens of billions of dollars to build. There is some skepticism on Capitol Hill about how exports would affect domestic prices, and the report is unlikely to quell some fears. Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden, who will chair the Senate Energy Committee come January, has been vocally skittish of exports, just the opposite of the top Republican on that committee, Senator Lisa Murkowski.
I think that that works to incent additional production, which is good for other sectors, whether it's the manufacturing sector. It's good for jobs. It's good for the balance of trade.
The report shows that large-scale exports could force prices up as much as 25%, but the prices would still be cheaper than 5 years ago. Senator Wyden's office issued a statement saying he'll continue to question the Department of Energy over whether exports will increase costs to industry that rely on domestic gas, industries like chemical manufacturers. The chemical industry is a major force in Louisiana, and so is the oil and gas industry. Democratic Senator Mary Landrieu says all industries would benefit from certainty.
It might be helpful for Congress to make a statement that, you know, natural gas export is in the best long-term interest of our country.
So far, only one terminal in the lower 48 has an export permit for LNG in Louisiana. Analysts are now speculating the Department of Energy may now rule on the dozen or so pending applications for new ones. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The National Park Service continues to push back against some state sport hunts in the interior. It's the latest skirmish in a battle over state and federal authority on preserves designated by the 1980 Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The National Park Service wants to continue temporary bans on certain bear, wolf, and coyote hunts in Denali, Gates of the Arctic, and Yukon-Charley Rivers National Preserves. Denali National Park spokeswoman Chris Pfister says the agency is overriding state hunts implemented by the Board of Game over the last 2 years.
Prohibit taking brown bears over bay chasins, using artificial light to taking black bears at dens, taking black bear cubs and sows with cubs, and would shorten the season for hunting wolves and coyotes.
Pfister says there's no precedent for the hunts on the western edge of Denali, and they're not in line with park mandates for protecting healthy wildlife populations. Yukon Charley and Gates of the Arctic managers are blocking bear baiting and the summer hunts for wolves and coyotes. Chief Ranger Gary Youngblood says the Park Service has been forced to take matters into its own hands.
Wildlife regulations are set by the state. We've communicated with the state through the Board of Game and asked them to exclude these regulations from taking place in our units. And this hasn't worked out, and their suggestion was that we use whatever processes we have to manage.
The federal process is park superintendents' compendiums, annual lists of temporary regulations. State of Alaska Acting Director of Wildlife Conservation Doug Vincent Lang says the Park Service is using values as a reason for overstepping hunting protections in the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act that created the affected preserve areas.
We think that since ANILCA basically guaranteed hunting and fishing rights, that they should be looking at everything through the lens of how does it affect hunting and fishing rights. If it doesn't affect conservation of the resource and it doesn't affect other park users, why would you preclude hunting and fishing when it was guaranteed under ANILCA?
Vincent Lang says he's hopeful that public comment on the Park Service proposals will sway the agency to drop its overrides of state sport hunting regulations, something he sees as a power grab and a trend.
It's a renewed intrusion of this traditional role of the state agency as the principal manager that we're seeing, and it's occurring in a lot of different parks and preserves on a wide range of different issues. And it is somewhat troubling to the state to see it.
Vincent Lang would not comment on the potential for legal action. The Park Service is holding public hearings on its proposals at several locations this month, including at Denali December 12th, Eagle on the 18th, and Bettles on the 20th. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The National Park Service has named Don Stryker as its new superintendent for Denali National Park. Stryker is currently superintendent for New River Gorge National Park in West Virginia. KTNA's Lorian Nettleton has the story.
When the National Park Service's Alaska Regional Director offered him the top position in one of the nation's most celebrated national parks, Don Stryker started thinking about making the move north with his family right away.
It's always been a goal of ours to get to Alaska. Sort of the final frontier, experience what that very different part of the United States is like. We're avid outdoors people, and we take very seriously sort of our connection to communities. And when we moved to Yellowstone, we really just sort of fell in love with the western sort of small community field. I mean, so we've had Alaska on our minds for many moves, and it was just a question of when would the timing be right.
As superintendent for New River Gorge National Park in West Virginia, Stryker has experience with co-managed landscapes. The New River is a wild and scenic river, and the New River National Recreation Area is adjacent to the park. As Stryker sees it, the goal is not to haggle over ownership of land, but to cooperate together for the greater good.
What's sort of neat when we start learning to evaluate the many challenges that are ahead of us at the landscape level is, in my mind, sort of the who owns what is not the issue that should take front and center. It's more, what are the areas that we all want to collectively focus on? And then how can we work together as effective equals, co-managing a larger landscape for things that benefit everybody?
Stryker's start date is in January, and despite the discouragement of the park management, he is considering driving the Alcan in January to start orientation in Anchorage. In Talkeetna, I'm Lorian Nettleton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Winter in Alaska can be tough on children and adults with asthma. Cold air and smoke from wood stoves is hard on the lungs. More time is spent indoors with dust, and colds and flus are common. Take care of yourself and loved ones with asthma during these colder months. Get a flu shot. Talk to your health care provider about asthma management. Take daily medication and know what can make asthma worse. For more information, visit asthmainalaska.org or call 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association. Get a career in less than a year in nursing or QMed or professional cooking and baking. Additional programs and course information online at avtech.edu. Classes in Seward and Anchorage start in January, so enroll now. This message sponsored by Avtech.
The certification of the House District 34 race this week has put Jonathan Christ Tompkins in the legislature. At 23 years old, he is almost the youngest person ever elected to state government. KCAW's Robert Woolsey has the story.
Terry Gardner was 22 when he was elected to represent Ketchikan in the legislature in 1972. Gardner had interned in both the Washington State Legislature and worked as an aide to Juneau Representative Mike Miller in Alaska. So he was already a familiar face in government when he won a seat in the Capitol, maybe a little too familiar, as he learned on the first day. He was standing in the doorway to the House, preparing to be sworn in.
And a senior legislator came along and was, been around many terms and was going into the chamber and assumed that I, this young person standing there, was one of the pages. And so she handed me this big pile of stuff and said, here, do X, Y, and Z, a typical task that pages would be asked to do. And so I just said, okay.
Gardner was not quite ready to burst this particular legislator's bubble. He finally did when a few minutes later she reminded him that pages were not permitted to sit in the legislator's chairs. After that initial misunderstanding, Gardner says his job was the same as any freshman legislator's, regardless of age.
I think it's a matter of just demonstrating that, you are serious, that you're willing to do your homework, that you're willing to listen to the senior members and learn from them, which you definitely need to do. That's how you learn. You can't learn it all by, reading the rule books. You do have to learn from the personal politics and get to know people, and that all takes time.
Gardner says he got in touch with Christ Tompkins through a mutual acquaintance late in the campaign and offered what advice he could. Gardner, maybe better than anyone, understands what Christ Tompkins is up against.
I was in the minority for my first term, so faced a similar situation that Jonathan will be a freshman, be young, and be in the minority. That's theoretically about as low on the totem as you can be.
Gardner received a committee chairmanship in his second term and eventually became speaker in 1978 at age 28. Pipeline politics, the permanent fund, and nonprofit hatcheries were all high-profile issues in his era. Gardner says he welcomed the input of lobbyists, at least those he trusted, whom he considered subject area experts. A lot of being in the legislature is sorting wheat from chaff because, Gardner says, the job never ends.
As a legislator, you don't have a huge staff, but you have an endless workload. You have all these constituents and groups and communities that need staff. And you need help.
Like Christ Tompkins, Gardner was just shy of graduating from college when he was elected. He was studying political science and history at Western Washington University and planned to use his experience running for the legislature as the basis of his senior thesis. Instead, he won, served 10 years, and then founded Silver Lining Seafoods. He doesn't miss that degree.
My time in the legislature, it was the best college education that one could ever hope for, because you are exposed to so many issues, you have to learn about so many issues, and there's all these experts there at your fingertips willing to give you information and opinions, and you hear both sides of an issue. No one could ever have a more educational time than to be a member of the legislature.
Gardner was about 22 years and 5 months old when he took office in January 1973. He holds the honor of Alaska's youngest legislator by just a couple of months over former representative and later state senator John Sackett, who took office in 1967 at the age of 22 years, 7 months. Sackett, however, was the youngest person ever elected president of the Tanana Chiefs Conference at age 21. Jonathan Christ Tompkins is a relative oldster. He'll be about 3 weeks shy of his 24th birthday when he takes office on January 15th. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
28 wrestlers from 7 Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta schools have qualified for the state wrestling tournament this Friday and Saturday in Nikiski. Two of these qualifying schools are almost complete opposites. One is a perennial powerhouse, while the other is sending kids to state for the very first time. KYUK's Mark Earhart has more.
Wrestlers from Akiachuk, Aniak, Bethel, Nebuskiak, Pilot Station, and Gwinnahawk are all going to the small school state wrestling tournament. Scammon Bay, a village of under 500 people along the Bering Sea coast, will be there as well. But unlike those other YK Delta communities, this is the first time Scammon has ever sent wrestlers to state. In fact, up until a few years ago, the school, which is in the Lower Yukon School District, didn't even have a wrestling team.
We're just kind of getting our program started out here at Scammon.
That's Scammon's coach, Harley Sundown. He says along with Alleghenuk, Emonic, Mountain Village, New Namaqua, and Hooper Bay, 6 out of the 11 LYSD schools have just recently established wrestling programs. Out of those, only Scammon Bay has any state qualifiers this year. Sundown says the entire community of Scammon Bay is excited about the tournament.
It's just something that the parents don't realize yet what it takes to be competitive at state, and that's something that I want to see firsthand because I've never been to a state wrestling tournament either.
If the state tournament is the exclamation point on the season, then what is it like at the beginning of the year? I asked Shane Unin exactly that.
It was scary at first.
But the freshman explains he became better and better with more and more time on the mat. So much better, in fact, he took third place at the qualifying tournament here in Bethel this past Friday. His sophomore teammate Fabian recounts what it was like to qualify.
It was pretty hard and tiring wrestling. There's competitors, and I think I did pretty well.
The Bethel Regional High School Warriors have won the past two small school state wrestling championships. Warriors coach Darren Lieb says last year was a close competition and says he expects much of the same this year.
There's a lot of tough teams out there, Cotsview, Valdez, Dillingham. And then you throw in all those smaller schools with, like, New Stuyuk. They have a lot of tough wrestlers. So
the state wrestling tournament is this Friday and Saturday in Nikiski. In Bethel, I'm Mark Earhart.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Lorian Nettleton in Talkeetna, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Mark Earhart in Bethel. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Crowley, working in Alaska for over 50 years. Crowley understands the importance of safe and reliable fuel delivery in Western Alaska. Crowley knows Alaska and is proud to support public radio. CPDAlaska.com.
And by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.